this week, even Hannity is starting to lay the groundwork for maybe it's not worth it to Trump to show up, when, of course, the reason it would be a risk for Trump to show up is that he's so incoherent, particularly during evening appearances, as multiple mental health professionals have pointed out. So bottom line, glad we're seeing a little bit more of this in corporate media. We have a voicemail number. You can call anytime if you have a message for me. I appeared on Megyn Kelly's program last week. Here is a caller weighing in on whether it is worth me doing these sorts of appearances or whether it's a waste of time. Take a listen.
Hey, David, this is Jeff from Colorado. I listened to your interview or whatever you want to call it with Megyn Kelly and their bozo friend. And that was worthless. Sorry. You did a great job. You did what you could, put it that way. I wouldn't waste time doing that again. There was no interest from Megyn or that other bozo and having any sort of honest discussion. So, anyway, nice job with it, though.
So here's the thing. I do agree in a sense. You know, Megyn Kelly and Hogan Gidley, they're double teaming me. It's 2-on-1. They're interrupting me. I get it. I do think that those appearances can be worthwhile because the clips then spread like wildfire. If you look on TikTok and on other platforms, a ton of creators are reposting the content, talking about the content, improving upon or even helping to elaborate better rebuttals to the things that I was faced with. I do think that there is this longer tail effect that can be positive. But as far as my time, I mean, it's, you know, between the dealing with the producers beforehand, they make you connect to Zoom a half hour early. It's an hour appearance. There's commercial breaks, all these different things. I could certainly be doing other things with my time. Just sitting around and reading a book, in a sense, would be maybe more personally productive. But I do think that there is value to this. So I see both sides. I don't know that they're necessarily going to have me back on, but I wouldn't write off the value of doing these sorts of things. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. The House has voted to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt. Why? And does this make any sense? We'll talk about it. North Dakota has passed a measure to impose age limits on congressional candidates. Why are they doing this? And does it make sense? And lastly, friend of the show and former guest, former Congresswoman Debbie McCarsel Powell is running against Republican Senator Rick Scott in Florida, and she is surging in the polls. This did not appear to be an in-play race 6 months ago. It very much now does. We will discuss that and so much more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it. Get instant access at joinpacman.com. I have new crime data to share with you today, and it may not shock some of you that we continue to see a sustained and pervasive decline in crime, all kinds of crime in the United States. The reason it might not be surprising to you, but it would be surprising to the regular consumers of Fox News and other right-wing media, is that one of the greatest stories that has been told over the last few years, in the absence of any serious criticisms of the Biden administration, is that it's really dangerous out there. Carjackings and sexual assaults and murder and all categories of crime that, of course, still exist in a country of 340 million people, but continue to decline, much broader decline, by the way, than anything we would just say is thanks to Joe Biden, but continuing to see these declines during the Biden administration. Now, they've already got their talking points. They've already got their rebuttals. We're going to go through them one by one so that you can be prepared and we can really kind of think through whether any of the criticisms of these data are valid. But starting at the top, ABC News reports FBI's latest data shows historic drop in crime. Reported incidents of violent crime dropped 15% according to the FBI data. When you read into this further, you see that this applies to really all types of crime. Murder down 26%. And you can go and read through it. Property crime, all sorts of different crime. So why is it that we see this and yet 26% reduction in murder, 25% reduction in rapes, 13% reduction in aggravated assaults, 18% reductions in robberies. And yet, this is not going to be convincing to the crowd that insists it's more dangerous than ever out there. And if they can somehow blame undocumented immigrants or documented immigrants, whatever, they'll blame whoever they can if they can get away with it. Why is this the case that we continue to hear these talking points from them? Well, part of it is...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This name became an impediment to our efforts to diversify. And because we're trying to look forward, we're like, yeah, we got to ditch it. We got to lose it. We got to get a name that doesn't present a barrier to everybody's participation. We're throwing the doors open for everybody and saying you're all welcome in Bernie.
New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society has officially changed its name to the NYC Bird Alliance. John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a slaveholder. As we mark Pride Month, we speak to Christian Cooper, a black birder and LGBTQ activist. He made headlines 4 years ago when a white woman in Central Park called 911 claiming he was threatening her life after he asked her to leash her dog.
She told me first, I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. And of course, you know, I'm like, whoa, you know, I'm not an idiot. I've grown up as a black man in America my whole life. I know this is a world of hurt potentially coming my way, but you know, I'm not gonna acquiesce to this and let this intimidate me.
Christian Cooper just won an Emmy for his National Geographic series, Extraordinary Birder. But first, we look at the Supreme Court's unanimous decision preserving access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The pill is used in nearly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Children in Gaza continue to die of hunger. On Thursday, the World Health Organization reported 32 deaths from malnutrition, most of whom were children under five. The findings came as UNICEF said nearly 3,000 children have been cut off from treatment for moderate and severe acute malnutrition in southern Gaza, putting them at risk of death. Meanwhile, the UN reports violence against children caught in armed conflict last year reached extreme levels, with a 21% increase in extreme violations. The surge in violence came amidst Israel's withering assault on the Gaza Strip, now in its ninth month. Overnight, Israeli forces pushed deeper into the Shabura refugee camp in southern Gaza. Elsewhere, one person was killed and three children wounded after Israel bombed their home in the Berej refugee camp. Israeli airstrikes in northern Gaza City killed at least 14 people. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed at least three Palestinians in overnight raids in the West Bank. The U.S. Supreme Court Thursday ruled unanimously to maintain access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used in nearly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. The decision comes as a relief to providers and patients across the nation. But advocates warn the far-right-dominated court's ruling on the FDA's authority to regulate the pill was purely on procedural grounds and could even offer a roadmap for future challenges. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote in the court's decision, quote, "The plaintiffs have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections, suggesting the proper venue for their case could be with the president, lawmakers, or federal regulators." We'll have more on this ruling after headlines with Professor Michelle Goodwin. In other Supreme Court news, justices ruled 8-1 in favor of Starbucks, which was accused of unlawfully firing seven workers at a Memphis store after they led a campaign to organize a union. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was the sole dissenter. Lynn Fox, president of Workers United, said the decision, quote, "underscores how the economy is rigged against working people all the way up to the Supreme Court," unquote. In Italy, G7 leaders have agreed on a plan to loan Ukraine $50 billion. G7 host and far-right Italian President Giorgia Meloni said Russian assets frozen after its 2022 invasion of Ukraine would be used to finance the deal. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky joined the talks, where he met with President Biden and signed a 10-year bilateral security agreement with the U.S. Biden announced the agreement at a joint news conference.
A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future. The United States is going to help ensure that Ukraine can do both, not by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine, but by providing weapons and ammunition, expanding intelligence sharing, continuing to train brave Ukrainian troops at bases in Europe and the United States.
On Thursday, at least 6 people were killed and 11 others wounded when a Russian missile struck the city of Kryvyi Rih in southern Ukraine. Much of Ukraine is experiencing extended blackouts as Russia's military increases attacks on the energy grid. As G7 leaders gathered for a lavish banquet Thursday evening, protesters gathered to host what they called a poor dinner.
A world with people who are getting richer and richer, and a world, a planet that is getting poorer and poorer, crossed by wars, death, destruction, climate change. So a planet that is going towards death, and they don't seem to care. We are on the eve of the Third World War.
Russian authorities say Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich will stand trial on espionage charges in Yekaterinburg, where he was arrested in March last year. The Wall Street Journal CEO and publisher slammed the what he called a sham trial, adding, quote, journalism is not a crime. If convicted, Gershkovich faces up to 20 years in prison. Christophe Deloire, the head of Reporters Without Borders for the last 12 years, has died at the age of 53 from complications of brain cancer. Deloire fought tirelessly to defend press freedom and persecuted journalists. A year ago, he appeared on Democracy Now!, where I asked him about Evan Gershkovich.
Is clearly a Russian state hostage, a sort of institutional hostage. If we know how Putin succeeded in the past decade, finalized it right after the beginning of the war, how he succeeded to extinguish, to re-suppress pluralism, independent journalism, to provoke an extinction in his own country.
To see our full interview with Christophe Deloire, you can go to democracynow.org. Here in New York, climate protests continued for a fourth day outside Citigroup headquarters Thursday, where police arrested 56 people, many of them elders. Thursday's protests, led by the group Third Act, came under the banner of the Rocking Chair Rebellion, which is part of the Summer of Heat series of actions. Senior citizens blocked Citigroup's entrance with more than 50 rocking chairs, demanding climate justice for future generations. Palestinian rights activists have also been protesting Citigroup this week, calling on the bank to stop funding Israel. The group Al-Auda says Citibank provided a $2.5 billion loan for Israel to purchase F-35 fighter planes in 2021 that the U.S. is now repaying. In Germany, climate experts say the high-level UN talks in Bonn have failed to make any progress on a global response to the climate catastrophe. This is Tasnim Esap of Climate Action Network International.
The climate talks in Bonn this year ended up with no results. And this is caused by a breakdown in the negotiations once again on finance. Rich nations, as they've done before, are not willing to make progress on their financial obligations to developing countries.
This comes as record-breaking extreme weather is being reported around the world. Authority in Athens shut down the Acropolis and other major sites during peak hours as Greece records its earliest ever seasonal heat wave. In Puerto Rico, the mayor of San Juan declared a state of emergency as the island reported widespread power outages, leaving some 350,000 customers without electricity Wednesday night amid soaring temperatures. Puerto Rico's power grid was taken over by the Canadian-American company Luma Energy in 2021, despite widespread public opposition. Puerto Ricans have continued to suffer persistent blackouts, yet pay some of the highest electricity rates in the United States. French President Emmanuel Macron has suspended voting reform in New Caledonia to allow, quote, a return to order, unquote. On a visit to the Pacific archipelago last month, Macron vowed to go ahead with the reform, which would grant voting rights to French residents of the colonized territory. But after Macron called a snap election Sunday, such a procedure could not go ahead until a new legislature is elected. At least 8 people have been killed in the recent unrest. Much of New Caledonia's indigenous Kanak community is seeking full independence from France. Here in the United States, Oklahoma Supreme Court has dismissed a lawsuit from the last 2 survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. An estimated 300 black people were killed when a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood. Viola Fletcher and Leslie Benningfield Randall are 110 and 109 years old. Their lawyers say they will request a rehearing by the Oklahoma Supreme Court and called on the Justice Department to open investigation into the massacre under the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act of 2007. Former President Donald Trump returned to the U.S. Capitol on Thursday for the first time since the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Trump met with Republican lawmakers, among other things. He reportedly said, quote, Milwaukee, where we're having our convention, is a horrible city, unquote. Trump narrowly lost Wisconsin to Biden in 2000 and has since falsely claimed election fraud in the state. This comes as Politico reports Trump called House Speaker Mike Johnson after he was convicted of 34 felonies in New York and asked the GOP leader to help overturn the verdict and to help punish the Justice Department. President Trump turns 78 years old today. And in Brazil, protesters took to the streets on Thursday after lawmakers advanced a bill this week that would equate all abortions with homicide if performed after the 22nd week of gestation, with punishments of up to 20 years in prison. This is Rio Councilmember Monica Benicio.
We will not accept a setback. We will not accept a conservative government negotiating spurious policies over our lives. We will continue to advance until legal abortion is a guaranteed right in Brazil.
Abortion is only legal in Brazil in cases of rape, anencephaly, or a life-threatening risk to the patient. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a closely watched case Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled to preserve access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used in roughly 2/3 of all U.S. abortions. The court did not address the safety of the pill and focused instead on the lack of standing by the anti-choice medical associations who filed a lawsuit in order to limit access to the drug approved more than 20 years ago by the Food and Drug Administration. Advocates warn the court's ruling could offer a roadmap for future challenges. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote the majority opinion. He said, quote, the plaintiffs have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections, unquote, suggesting the proper venue for their case could be with the president, lawmakers, or federal regulators. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke from the White House after the ruling.
This is not a cause for celebration. Because the reality is certain things are still not going to change. We are looking at the fact that 2/3 of women of reproductive age in America live in a state with a Trump abortion ban. This ruling is not going to change that. This ruling is not going to change the fact that Trump's allies have a plan that, if all else fails, to eliminate medication abortion through executive action.
The Supreme Court will soon rule on another case that aims to strip pregnant people of their right to abortion care in order to stabilize an emergency medical condition. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans blocked a bill Thursday to protect access to in vitro fertilization and voted last week against the Right to Contraception Act. For more, we're joined by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She hosts the Ms. Magazine podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin and is the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. In 2021, her guest essay for The New York Times was headlined, I Was Raped by My Father and Abortion Saved My Life. Professor Goodwin, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you respond to the Supreme Court's unanimous decision, what it means and what it doesn't mean?
What it means is that mifepristone, which is used as part of a two-drug regimen in order to terminate pregnancy, it's the majority of pregnancy terminations, abortions in the country take place with mifepristone. What this means is that it continues to be available nationwide. It means that people may not be criminally punished for using this to help a patient terminate a pregnancy. But as the vice president said, it should not be overstated what this ruling means. This was a ruling on procedural grounds, not substantive grounds. And it's worth noting how far this group of litigants got. They framed themselves as doctors who would be affected by patients who had some distress, medical distress after abortion. That itself was something of a tremendous falsehood. Mifepristone is safer than using aspirin and Tylenol. The Supreme Court has acknowledged in 2016 that a woman is 14 times more likely to die carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. So the underlying premise that the drug is unsafe, that abortions are unsafe, was factually not true. It was also an incredible reach that somehow this claim that the FDA had rushed this drug to the marketplace, when in the year that it was approved, the FDA had spent three times the length of time reviewing this drug compared to other drugs that came into the marketplace that year. So the drug is efficacious and the drug was safe. And yet these plaintiffs were able to get as far as the Supreme Court in bringing this case. And that says so much.
What role does telemedicine play in providing access to abortion pills, and how will it be affected?
Well, what this also means is that telemedicine can continue to be used in order to help people be able to terminate a pregnancy. Part of the challenge to this case by these people who brought it—this is also important, Amy, these are people who claim to be doctors. Amongst them was a person who has a master's degree in theology who would never get medical admitting privileges at any hospital. Another one, a dentist who's not a person that one would seek to have help in a gynecological ward. But that said, they claim to be doctors who would be put in a difficult position helping someone to be relieved after complications with an abortion. What this case does do with telemedicine is that it keeps it alive. And it's important to understand the playbook behind all of this. Part of the playbook is to find any kinds of opportunities, holes, et cetera, and to pierce them to try to use the United States Supreme Court, district courts, courts of appeals in any kind of way to further limit and diminish the ability to be able to access reproductive freedom. And so it's not even just about abortion. You'll find that this case and others like it are open doors to also diminishing the right to access contraception, the ability to be able to get things in the mail that help you with your reproductive health. This is just one of the strikes, not the first strike, not the second or third, but one of the strikes in an artillery that is aimed at reproductive freedom.
Can you explain judge shopping, who the Trump-appointed judge Matthew Kaczmarek is in Amarillo, Texas, and what he has to do with this case?
This is a great question, because what's come open in the wake of so many of the appointments that the former president was able to make, Donald Trump was able to nominate and get through the confirmation process more federal judges than any other president save George Washington. And many of the people that were part of that nomination process were people who showed a coolness towards cases like Brown v. Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, et cetera. So Judge Kaczmarek is one of them. He was an activist, is an activist, an anti-abortion activist. He's written about his anti-abortion views. He has been quite outspoken about his anti-abortion views, save for a publication that he had had his name removed when he was going through the confirmation process, which was going to be published by a Texas University of Texas Law Review. He had his name his name taken off of that, but it was an article that was about abortion and his opposition. So this group of litigants brought their case before Judge Kaczmarek, who's the only sitting judge in Amarillo, Texas, a person with known anti-abortion views. And what they had hoped to do was to play off of his anti-abortion views by bringing this case before him. Now, what this also says is a lot about how the U.S. judiciary has been functioning in recent years. There's supposed to be objectivity, arm's-length distancing, such that if one has personal views that may be oppositional on matters of race and sex and LGBTQ equality, that is not supposed to infect the process of judging. Many have said that that's exactly what happened in this case, that there was an infection that was here with Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, that he allowed his personal views, which have been widely expressed, to influence how he handled this case, including on the matter of standing. The fact that the United States Supreme Court unanimously threw out this case saying that these plaintiffs have no standing, it should not have gotten that far, and Judge Kaczmarek was the one who opened the door to it.
Professor Goodwin, what does the next move of anti-abortion crusaders look like based on this Supreme Court result? And if you can talk about EMTALA and what it means.
Yes. Well, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act says it all, doesn't it, in its name. When Congress enacted this law, it was intended to protect all Americans, and quite specifically, women who would be in distress during pregnancy. At the time in which this federal law was passed, there were poor pregnant women who were literally, Amy, being dumped on the side of roads. These were women who had no health insurance. Of course, there's not universal health care in the United States. Since EMTALA's enactment, there's been the federal protections of health care, the Obamacare, but it's not universal health care. But at the time, women were being dumped on the side of roads. Poor women were showing up at American hospitals in labor, sometimes in very stressful conditions, women who needed miscarriage being managed. And they were literally being turned away because they didn't have insurance or the right insurance. Because of deaths and tragedies that were associated with this, Congress passed this law, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, otherwise known as EMTALA, that grants all Americans the privilege, the right to be stabilized when they are in a health care crisis. You can imagine what this might mean if someone is suffering a heart attack, a stroke, needing to manage a miscarriage, going to a hospital, and the hospital saying, sorry, we can't stabilize you, we can't treat you. Well, there's another case that is being seen by the court, that the court will be ruling on soon, that involves Idaho's challenge to EMTALA's application to women who need their pregnancies managed, their miscarriages managed. Idaho claims that EMTALA should not apply to the state. This raises very serious questions in American constitutionalism, American rule of law, because federal law always supersedes and trumps states' laws. But in the wake of the anti-abortion movement and the forcefulness of it, you hear these kinds of claims coming from governors and states' attorneys general that federal law doesn't matter. Federal law cannot supersede or trump what the state is seeking to do, specifically on matters of reproductive health. We saw that before the Dobbs decision, when the state of Texas passed its SB 8 law, which banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. That was a showdown against Roe v. Wade that the United States Supreme Court turned a blind eye to and let stand. Well, now Idaho is doing the same. We'll see how the Supreme Court comes out on this. But let me also say this, Amy. This issue of the Comstock Act, this Comstock law, dating back to 1873, it's another weapon in the arsenal of the anti-abortion movement. This is a playbook, so turning to the playbooks of times in which slavery existed or just after slavery, a time in which women couldn't vote, had very limited representation within law at all, times in which marital rape was permissible, marital domestic violence permissible. So part of the anti-abortion movement is to look back at a time in which women barely had citizenship by law in the United States and to pull from that past in order to inform the present and the future.
Michelle Goodwin, I want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Coming up, New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society changes its name. Why? John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a slaveholder. Today, we mark Pride Month with the rest of the show speaking to Christian Cooper, black birder and LGBTQ activist. Made headlines 4 years ago when a white woman in Central Park called 911 claiming he was threatening her life after he asked her to leash her dog. Back in 30 seconds. All the Things You Are by Charlie Parker, affectionately known as Bird. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society has officially changed its name to the NYC Bird Alliance. John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a 19th century French-American naturalist and a slaveholder. Espoused racist views. In March, the National Audubon Society voted to retain the Audubon name. That set off a revolt among leaders of local chapters of the society. On Thursday, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Christian Cooper, longtime board member of New York City Bird Alliance. He's also a longtime LGBTQ activist and served as co-chair of the board of directors of GLAAD in the 1980s. In May of 2020, Christian Cooper made national headlines after a white woman in Central Park called 911 on him, falsely claiming that Cooper, who's black, was threatening her life. The woman, Amy Cooper, no relation to him or me, made the call after Christian Cooper asked her to follow park rules and put her dog on a leash. They were in an area of the park popular with birders. Video of the incident went viral in part because it happened on the same day that police in Minneapolis murdered George Floyd. Christian Cooper went on to write a memoir titled Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. The paperback has just come out. He also hosted the National Geographic episode series Extraordinary Birder, for which he just won a Daytime Emmy Award in the Outstanding Daytime Personality category. I began by asking Christian about the NYC Bird Alliance's decision to drop the Audubon name.
So there's a couple of things you have to know about the Audubon name as sort of background. There's the National Audubon Society, of which the organization I'm in is a chapter. But there are many, many organizations that use the name Audubon, and they're not necessarily all affiliated with each other. So, you know, there's various Audubons that have nothing to do with National Audubon. So there's that. And then the other thing you need to know is that when the name Audubon was first assigned to a North American birding organization, it was a bunch of ladies who lunch who decided to create a bird conservation organization, which is great. But Audubon was 50 years dead. He had nothing to do with the founding of the organization. It was these ladies who said, yeah, well, name it after him because he was a major part of North American birding and making it so visible. So his name being attached to the organization, he really didn't have anything to do with the organization itself. And then there are lots of different organizations that use the name Audubon. So National Audubon decided not to change the name, and a lot of us chapters said, you know what? we're going to go and change our names anyway. So it's been sort of almost like dominoes. A lot of chapters have sort of settled on the name Bird Alliance, which is wonderful because it means that at least on the ground, the network is changing bit by bit and settling on a common name. So I know...
But tell us more about who John Audubon was.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, what you can't take away from him is that he put birds, North American birds, on the map. And that was principally through his amazing art. We're lucky enough to be in New York City, where the New York Historical Society has the original Audubons, not the original prints, the original paintings. And I was lucky enough to see those at the New York Historical Society, and they are astonishing. They're gorgeous. You can't take that away from the guy. You do have to put an asterisk on it, which says, yeah, and his work was funded by the trafficking in other human beings. And it's that part that makes it very difficult for us looking forward when we're trying to diversify birding, which traditionally has been a very, very white activity, in the most diverse city in the world, or certainly in the country. So this name became an impediment to our efforts to diversify. And because we're trying to look forward, we're like, yeah, we got to ditch it. We got to lose it. We got to get a name that doesn't present a barrier to everybody's participation. We're throwing the doors open for everybody and saying, you're all welcome in birding.
But the National Audubon Society has not decided to go this route. What are the chapters? Some like Seattle?
Right. Seattle has picked a new name. Wisconsin, a couple of Wisconsin chapters have picked a new name. Illinois has picked a new name. Or Chicago has picked a new name. I lose track. There have been so many that have changed names. And a lot of us, though not all of us, have settled. Oh, Georgia picked a new name, but a lot of us have settled on Bird Alliance as the new name. So we are now the NYC Bird Alliance, and the hope is that, and the idea is not, you know, to erase Audubon, to cancel Audubon. You can't. The man's history is what it is. You know, like I said, you've got to give it an asterisk, but it's there. It's real. But that doesn't mean you got to have that name on your organization, particularly when you're trying to take an organization that for so long has been almost exclusively white, and you're trying to get other people involved. You know, you don't, for example, imagine you were a country club that had a history of excluding Jews. And you're like, oh my goodness, we got to change that. We've got to invite some Jews. Hey, guys, don't you want to join the Joseph Mengele Country Club? How many Jews are you going to get? You're not. That's kind of what we were facing with Audubon. So it's not a matter of erasing him. The history is still there. It comes with an asterisk, but it's there. But looking forward and getting everybody involved. And why is it so important to diversify? Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because we have lost one-third of our birds in North America. I'm not talking about species. I'm talking about raw numbers. The populations are down in my lifetime. I know this because I go out there and I bird and I feel it and I see it, and we all do. We have lost one-third of the birds in North America just in my lifetime since I started birding when I was about 10 years old. And the only way we're going to turn this around, because we can turn it around, we've done it in New York City in some ways, is if we get everybody involved in birding that possibly could be interested, because the country is diversifying. New York City is already a diverse city. If we don't have all hands on deck, we're not going to be able to save the birds.
So, Christian, you exploded onto the national scene a few years ago because of an incident in Central Park. And let's go back to that day. We're talking about Memorial Day 2020. So it's in the height of the pandemic. Everyone is masked. There are no vaccines. It is horrifyingly also the day that George Floyd was killed. But when you were out in Central Park that morning, he was still alive. Mm-hmm. And we want to turn to what happened on that day. Describe to us what time you went out in the morning and what you were doing and then what happened.
condensed version. I got out at 5:30, which is my usual time to hit the park that time of year. I'm looking for birds. It was a relatively slow day. There was a particular bird called the morning warbler, which is typically one of the last warblers to come through in the migration. So this is very late in the migration, and I'm looking for a morning warbler. Morning warblers are skulkers. They stay close to the ground for the most part, hidden in the shrubs. So I'm heading towards this patch of shrubs to look for a morning warbler.
How did you know it was there?
Oh, I didn't know it was there. I'm hoping to find it. So I'm keeping my ears open for cheery, 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 chory. Cheery, 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 chory. That's the song of the morning warbler. And if I hear that, and I know there's one hiding in those shrubs, and I got to wait him out and look for him. So I'm heading for a patch of habitat of low-lying growth where I'm likely to find one. And then I hear, Henry! At the top of the lungs, the way nobody would talk to a human being. So I know it's a dog off the leash. And then I see it tearing exactly through the low-growing growth where I was hoping to find a morning warbler. I'm like, well, if there was one there before, there's not one there now. So this is an ongoing problem in Central Park, particularly in the Ramble, where dogs have to be on the leash at all times. There are signs posted everywhere telling everybody that. So this has been an ongoing war between certain dog walkers. I don't want to tar all dog walkers with a bad brush, because there are some who actually follow the rules. But this has been an ongoing war for many, many, many years between dog walkers and birders. And so, you know, we got into it. I'm like, you know, look, your dog's supposed to be on the leash. The sign's right there. Look, all you have to do is take the dog across the road there to that other part of the park. You're outside the Ramble. You can have your dog off the leash until 9 a.m. and we're all good. She was having none of it. So at that point, we started to get into it and, you know, verbally and
you're how many feet away from her?
Well, much further than you are from me. So,
you're both wearing masks.
Yeah, I've got like a bandana over my face at that point because we didn't really have mask protocols yet, and she's got a mask on, and then so she eventually ends up picking up the dog by the collar,
not leashing it, but picking it up,
right
by the collar,
right, because let's not relive the whole thing, but the bottom line is I start recording her with my iPhone because that's one of the strategies we have when people are breaking the rules is to document it. It puts pressure on them because most people don't like to be recorded breaking the rules, and it's documentation for us to show the Parks Department.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
Please
call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
I'm sorry, I'm in the Ramble, and there's a man, African-American, he has a bicycle helmet. He's recording me and threatening me and my dog. There is an African-American man. I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog. And my dog. I'm sorry, I can't share with you that. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately. I'm in Central Park in the Ramble. I don't know.
And at that point, you know, I had a decision to make, because it was clearly an attempt to, you know, racially intimidate me to get what she wanted, which was for her to be able to have her dog running around as she saw fit. And, you know, neither of us was really willing to budge. We were both incredibly stubborn in that moment. And I just thought, you know, I'm not going to be complicit in my own dehumanization. I am not going to acquiesce here. I'm just going to keep doing what I would do whether I was black, brown, green, or purple, which is record her until that dog is on the leash. And whatever happens is going to have to be on her. So she, you know, called the police and did all that. And then it's funny because you see the video, and the second she puts that dog on the leash, I am done with her. I'm like, thank you, click, and I go on. I go back to burning.
But say again what she continued to repeat on the phone, what you understood when she called 911.
Right. She said, well, she told me first, I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. And, of course, you know, I'm like, whoa. You know, I'm not an idiot. I've grown up as a black man in America my whole life. I know this is a world of hurt potentially coming my way, but, you know, I'm not gonna acquiesce to this and let this intimidate me.
So talk about what happened with that video then.
I put it on Facebook because I have a tendency to put what happened that's notable to me on Facebook after a day of birding. Usually it's a bird. This was not a bird, but I put it on Facebook. Immediately, one or two friends called me up and said, can you make this public so I can share it? And I'm like, all right, fine. And then my sister called me, and she was seething, understandably. And she said, can I put it on Twitter? And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, put it on Twitter. And then it just kind of exploded and became a thing. And, you know, became even more of a thing because it ended up being on the same day that George Floyd was murdered. So, you know, it was a window, I think, for a lot of people into what we African-Americans know, because we live it every day. But I think for a lot of people who aren't African-American, they were able to see in those two videos, you know, the use of racial bias and how it informs policing, or people try to use it in policing sometimes, and then the actual police response, you know, against African-Americans that gets us killed. So it opened some eyes, I think, maybe, that hadn't been open before for a while.
Did the police come?
They did eventually come, or as I understand it, but by then we were both long gone. You know, I considered at the moment staying around to clear things up with the police, and then I thought, no, she doesn't get to do that. I'm here to bird, and I'm going back to birding. And, you know, and if I run into the police, fine, then I'll tell them what happened. But meanwhile, I'm looking for birds. And I did that, and no police came, and then I left the park and went home.
Did you find the warbler?
I did not find the morning warbler that morning.
So Cyrus Vance was the Manhattan DA. Talk about what they wanted to happen and your response overall and what happened to Amy Cooper.
So the bottom line is Cyrus Vance wanted to, you know, it was a very public case. So the Manhattan DA wanted to prosecute her for filing a false report, which is fine. You know, that's his prerogative. He wanted my participation in that, and that's where I had to make a decision as to whether or not I was going to pursue it. And I chose not to. And that was a hard decision. And I know a lot of people, especially black people, you know, were not happy with that decision. But I had to kind of trust my conscience, and my conscience said, you know, her life had imploded. She lost her job. She was a pariah nationwide. You know, if none of that is going to send a message to people, this is not the thing to do, then I'm not sure anything will. It felt like piling on my part, and so I was just like, you know what, you have the ability to pursue these charges without me. Please, you know, go ahead and do so if you feel the need. I don't feel like I need to participate in this. So that was what I decided. And it was a hard decision because I get it. You know, this was possibly precedent setting that, you know, when there are so many cases where black people have been falsely accused and suffered for it, to actually get someone for doing that. So I understand why it was important, particularly to a lot of black people. But ultimately, my conscience said, you know, this is not the way to go. And there's something more important, which is that keep your eyes on the prize. You know, we can spend our time throwing Amy Cooper behind bars and pat ourselves on the back that, oh, yeah, we got that one. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is rolling back affirmative action. And, you know, and Florida is changing education on black people so that it's, you know, a happy, happy, sunny, sunny time, you know, for 300 years. Which of these things are more important? Where should we put our focus? What should we really be changing? You know, meanwhile, the people in Washington, D.C., the largely black and brown population in Washington, D.C., still don't have representation, even though there's more people there than in all-white Wyoming and all-white Vermont. And they each get two senators. Washington, D.C. gets nothing. Which of these things should we put our focus and our energy on is going to really make a change? So, you know, Amy Cooper, her life is hers. Let her live it as she sees fit. You know, whatever she makes of it from here on in, you know, judge her by that, and it's up to her. You know, but my energy was focused on eyes on the prize, you know, making real progress for us.
We'll be back with Christian Cooper in 20 seconds.
Paul and Silas bound in jail.
Had no money for the gore, babe. No. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on, hold on.
Hold on.
Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Eyes on the Prize, performed by Sweet Honey and the Rock and James Horner. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're continuing our conversation with Christian Cooper, author of Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. He talked about how he got into birding.
My father was a science teacher for his whole life, and for a good stretch of that, a biology teacher. So nature was always very important to him, and he took us camping a lot as kids. So nature was always very important in our household. For me, for whatever reason, it took the particular form of birds. I built a bird feeder and put it up in the backyard, and I saw this bird coming to it, and it was all black with a patch of red on the wings, and I was like, I've discovered this new species of crow. And I was like excited with my, you know, tour de force of youthful scientific discovery, and then found out it was a red-winged blackbird. But it's still one of my favorite birds to this day. And that's what you would call my spark bird, which is in the lingo of bird watchers. That's the bird that gets you started birding. And after that, it was just sort of like going down the rabbit hole. So that's what started it at about 9 or 10. And I just kept at it. And then my dad took me to the bird walks of the South Shore Audubon Society, which at the time were led by this guy named Elliot Kuttner, who was just like ebullience personified. And he took one look at me and my interest in birds, and he was like, this one's mine. And from then on, you know, it was great. He nurtured that interest.
How did it come to serve as a kind of, because you mentioned that several times in the book, as a kind of refuge from the different forms of marginalization or exclusion that you felt, both as a black man and also as someone who's queer.
Yeah, and also it was a part of the marginalization, ironically, because, you know, being a birder in the 70s in junior high and high is not going to make you the most popular kid on the planet. No, but what it is, and this is true for everybody, I would say, is that birding forces you outside of yourself. Whatever your woes are. For me, it was, you know, being in the closet, because I know I was gay from, like, the age of 5. For me, it was being in the closet. You know, if you're worried about your rent, if you're worried about, you know, oh, my God, my life is a misery, I have this illness or whatever, and then you get outside. And you're looking for birds. And so, first of all, you're in this beautiful, you know, natural setting or semi-natural setting. So that calms you down, takes you outside yourself. But then if you want to see birds, you've got to focus. You've got to be listening and looking, or else you're not going to see any birds. And when you do that, you're engaging with the world around you in such a way that whatever those woes are, for at least a little while, they fall away. And it's very meditative, it's transporting, it makes you feel connected to the whole planet. It engages your senses, your intellect. It is incredibly healing, and that's one of the reasons why I'm like, black people do this! Because if there's anybody in this society that needs healing, that needs to have our woes fall away for a while, it's us. And then add the fact that, you know, birds are the ultimate symbol of freedom. Because there is no part of the planet that is inaccessible to them. They can fly. They are symbols of freedom. So for a people whose history is about being enslaved, for us to be able to relate to this bird, it's liberating. So that's why I think birding was so important for me as a kid, and why I just think everybody, but particularly black people, should be birding in droves.
You become head of the Harvard Ornithological Society, the club.
Yes, I have to put a caveat on that because, you know, there were like 3 or 4 of us. So it's not like some epic accomplishment.
But you also come out to your roommates and your friends there. Mm-hmm. And talk about those moments. Talk about the humanity of that, as we're in the middle of Pride Month right now, in the middle of June. And we also want to talk about the activism of ACT UP and the LGBTQ community, even beyond specifically LGBTQ issues, but it becomes a parallel paradigm for activism right through to today.
Well, and remember that, you know, that paradigm was picked up from the Vietnam anti-war movement and from the civil rights movement and from the feminist movement. So, you know, there, it's a strand of activism that goes way back, and you know, the LGBTQ community, we've been able to pick it up and keep it going. And who knows who'll pick it up after us. But, well, the trans community is picking it up. They're part, I consider them part of the, well, they're the T in LGBT. but, you know, they're the ones who are really under attack right now. And they are fighting fiercely and boldly and wonderfully and happily and with joy. More often than not. And it's glorious to see. It's often said that the greatest act of activism that someone who's queer can perform is to come out and be out and live out. And so for me, that was really the turning point in college. Freshman year, I had hoped to go to Harvard and finally break out of this suffocating closet that I was in. The only person who knew that I was gay was Deb, and I had only told her, like, the second semester of senior year in high school. So I'm like, all right, whole new life in Harvard, and I get to Harvard, I'm making these great friends, and I'm back in the closet. And the metaphor I always use is being in the closet felt like being buried alive. Because you know you're there, but nobody else knows. They're, like, walking over your grave and don't even realize it, and you are banging on that coffin lid, needing to be let out, and you can't get out, and nobody hears you. That's the experience of being in the closet. So I was done with it by about one semester, my first semester freshman year. I'm like, something has to give, or I'm gonna, you know, not make it. So I went to each of my roommates one by one and told them, you know, look, because we were talking about rooming together the next year, and I said, well, then there's something you need to know, which is that I'm gay. And they all took it well. The last one I told was my friend Mike. We actually shared a bedroom. And he was like, ha, 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 because we were always, you know, pulling gags on each other. He's like, ha, ha, ha. And I was like, and he said, really? I said, yeah, really. And there was this pause where you could see his brain kind of working through it. And then finally he said, it's cool. And that was it. And from then on, you know, we were just a group of, you know, guys who were bonded together and stayed together for the 4 years of college.
Which takes us to The Extraordinary Birder. Talking about television for a minute, you have now starred in this National Geographic series. And congratulations for getting this Daytime Emmy in the Outstanding Daytime Personality category. So despite what you say, you are an extraordinary birder.
Well, you haven't seen my nighttime personality. It's horrifying.
Well, I want to turn to the introduction that plays at the beginning of each episode of Extraordinary Birder.
Look at all those ravens. I'm Christian Cooper, and I am a birder. Oh, that was cool. My dad was a biology teacher and gave me my first pair of binoculars when I was about 10 years old, and I never put them down. Wow, not something I've seen in my life. Now I'm traveling the globe to explore the world of birds. That's amazing. It's like a cloud. And their relationship with us, those of us who don't have wings. Hold this! And along the way, I'll show you what I adore about these crazy smart. Your first look at the outside world. Dazzling. It's fantabulous. And super-powered feathered creatures.
This is a clip from the Extraordinary Birder episode called Birds of Puerto Rico, again hosted by our guest, Christian Cooper.
The best part of birding on an island is finding species that can't be found anywhere else. We birders call them endemics. This place is home to 17 endemic species of birds, and I'm hoping to spot a few of them to add to my life list. The Puerto Rican parrot is a special bird. With its bright green and blue feathers and red-striped brow, it's the pride of all Puerto Ricans. Way back, the island's Taino Indians named it Iguaca, after the squawking sound it makes when it flies. Sadly, nature's dealt the Iguaca a bit of a rough hand. And between hurricanes, hungry predators, and a lack of environmental protection, they were down to just 13 birds in the wild in the early 1970s. Now, there's a plan to bring them back.
A clip from Extraordinary Birder, National Geographic series. Christian Cooper just won an Emmy for this series. It's amazing. So tell us the countries that you went to for this series.
Well, that's the thing. Because it was COVID and because of budget, they kept us domestic for the season. So we went to Palm Springs, California, New York City, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, Hawaii, I had to go to Hawaii, and Alabama. And the Alabama episode was the most important to me because that was the collision not just of birding, but of family history and civil rights history. And you would be surprised how these things can inform each other. And we explored that a little bit in the episode. I had gone down to Alabama a year earlier at the invitation of Alabama Audubon, and the experience for me was so enlightening that I wanted to recreate it for the viewers. So the Alabama episode is
tell us
favorite.
More about Alabama and how all these worlds intersect.
Sure. Well, for example, I walked across for the first time the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is where Bloody Sunday happened. And so I'm walking across and thinking about what happened on this bridge. And meanwhile, there are cliff swallows that are nesting underneath it. And I realize, you know, these cliff swallows were probably here all those years ago, and they witnessed, they were there, they were part of that history to be there when all that happened. So there's that connection. Then there's other things like my father's family, you know, we're all Northerners for generations, but you go far enough back in the history of any African Americans and our roots are in the South. And my dad's father's side of the family came from Alabama, but I had never been. And I didn't want to go because I'm like, my family left there for a reason. I had never been to the Deep South. But the chance to go in the tender arms of Alabama Audubon made it. I'm like, well, if there's ever going to be a chance to go, this is it. So I went. And it was fascinating to see what expectations were violated, what expectations were affirmed. For example, walking around in Birmingham and there are all these cafes with rainbow flags in the window. And I'm like, wait, what? But, you know, that actually makes sense because, you know, you go across the country. And in the urban areas, they tend to be pretty progressive and actually very welcoming of queer people. But then you go outside, even here in New York, you know, you're here in the city. And it's very welcoming to queer people. But if you go to regions upstate, you know, there are parts where it's redder than red Iowa or something like that. So, you know, that was a revelation to me. But then other things, like the fact that, you know, my family had left Alabama and come to the North. Why? Because there was, you know, that was part of the Great Migration, when black people left the South for opportunity in the North, economic opportunity, jobs, and to escape oppression. That's exactly what birds do every year. That's why they migrate. They leave the South for the North because there are resources in the North that they can exploit to raise their young and be more successful and pass on a better life to the next generation. That's why black people left the South. And we even use the same word, migration, for the birds, the Great Migration for black people. So things like that, you know, just all sort of collide and inform each other and change your view of things.
And then you know, as you said earlier, for the National Geographic series, you weren't able to travel abroad because of COVID and so on. But you did, and you write about it in the book, you did actually go to several countries on your own, including Nepal, Tanzania. You said earlier that you'd also been to Belize. I mean, these are countries that are at the forefront of the climate crisis, which is, of course, also threatening all forms of nature, including birds. So if you could say a little about what you saw in these places, and this is obviously a limited number, I imagine you've been to many other places to bird, and the concerns you have about the climate crisis and the threat that it poses to bird life.
The best example I can give you is a trip I took in December down to Antarctica. I know, it was amazing. It's like visiting a different planet. But we got down there, and I was sort of, you know, a special guest on the boat, and so I wanted to, you know, be helpful to the other people on the ship and tell them, all right, well, we're going to make our landing at this particular spot, and I researched what kind of penguins we were going to see there. I said to everybody, all right, well, this is the penguin we're likely to see at this spot, and we get there. This is a colony of Adelie penguins, and we get there, and it's almost entirely Gen 2 penguins, and I'm like, ugh. I botched that completely. The penguin researcher on the boat said to me, no, you don't understand. I was here 2 years ago, and that colony was almost entirely Adelie penguins. Adelie penguins are true Antarctic penguins. They rely on ice for making their livelihood. Gen 2 penguins are what they call sub-Antarctic penguins, and the lack of ice is what lets them spread. So the fact that in 2 years, that colony had converted almost entirely from Adelie penguins, the Antarctic penguins, to Gen 2 penguins is a sign of just how quickly climate change is happening, particularly down there, because it's changing faster at the poles than any place else. So we were able to see in real time ourselves that our climate is changing way faster than most creatures can adapt. And, you know, there will be winners and losers. You know, Gen 2 penguins, at least for a while, are going to, you know, have an advantage. But what's scary is that most species can't adapt to change successfully that's that fast, including us.
Christian Cooper, author of Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. He's just won an Emmy for his National Geographic series Extraordinary Birder. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You've got your radio dial set to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Cousins and friends. is he so evil? He wants more pay for his working day, and he says that kids like me should be in school.
Good morning. Kenny Joe here. You're in Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh. The song you just heard was by Kate and Anna McGarrigle off of their CD Matipedia, Jacques et Gilles is the name of the song. We're going to be here for the next hour or so. Now, normally, our job here is to